ಪೂರ್ಣಮಸ್ಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮಾದಾಯ ಪೂರ್ಣಮೇವಾವಶಿಷ್ಯತೆ. ಓಂ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ.
ನೌ ಯೆಸ್ಟರ್ಡೇ ಐ ವಾಸ್ ಡಿಸ್ಕಸಿಂಗ್ ಒನ್ ವೆರಿ ಇಂಪಾರ್ಟೆಂಟ್ ಆಸ್ಪೆಕ್ಟ್ ಆಫ್ ಕರ್ಮಯೋಗ, ದಟ್ ಮೀನ್ಸ್ ಅಟ್ ದಿ ಸಬ್ಜೆಕ್ಟಿವ್ ಲೆವೆಲ್. ವೆನ್ ಎವರ್ ವಿ ಡೂ ಸಮಥಿಂಗ್ ನೋಬಲ್, ಟೋಟಲಿ ಅನ್ಸೆಲ್ಫಿಶ್, with a sense of surrender of the results of our actions as an offering, or even just any kind of action which is not related to any expectation, fulfillment of any desire, that action immediately has the effect of soothing our mind. We feel as if we have done something noble. It is a very subtle feeling and experience that is totally different from the satisfaction that we get when our business produces a lot of profits, when the bank account is very good. Now, the satisfaction that comes out of this later results, it's superficial, and as I said earlier, it is only one side of the coin. The joy that we get out of any material benefits is not really joy. It is only the absence of its opposite. The happiness at the empirical level, worldly level, is not really happiness. It is only the absence of unhappiness. And that state of the absence of unhappiness will quickly change and may become unhappiness itself when what we get today is lost tomorrow. So any noble action produces this inward result. And as I said yesterday, it is this inner feeling of inner spiritual contentment that enables us to keep going, to do service for others, to help charitable institutions, spiritual organizations, or just the incentive to do something noble and unselfish. Everything needs an incentive. At a material level, incentive takes the form of money, promotion, some benefits, profits. At a spiritual level, there is also an incentive, but this is subtle. And our scriptures say our first step should be to look for this incentive. Try to get something subtle, this inner fulfillment. It is not really desire. Then somebody would say, well, I will not try to realize God because that is utter selfishness. I won't realize God, so I won't do that. I won't try to help anyone because that will make me egoistic. So I won't do any help to anybody. And there's an interesting scene in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna says, he asked somebody to bring water. He didn't bring it. Maybe a narration in some other context. But in the Gospel it comes. The person didn't do that. But if he does something like that, it doesn't make him egoistic. I have done something noble, so I should not do it. I won't give you a donation because if I help you, that would make me proud of having helped you. So I won't do any help to anyone. So the first step should be to do something noble. And in the Gita, you find an evolution of the concept of karma that is very crucial to understanding the message of Gita. The first step. You read the whole 18 chapters. In the first chapter on 28th verse, Arjuna puts forward a complaint to Krishna. I shall quote the verse and then I will explain. You know, there is a reason that some of you may make use of the recordings and you can look at the text. In the 28th verse of the first chapter, Arjuna begins his dialogue. Dushtvevam sujanam Krishna yutsum samavastidam sidanti mamagatrani nukham chakarishishiri vebadushya sarireme roma hashashya jayidi dandivam samsade hasva tuchyiva paridekshiri. So Arjuna has come to the battlefield. So remember, the battlefield background of Gita is liable to create many misunderstandings. So that should be understood. Anyway, Gandhiji interprets this as the battlefield of a spiritual life, of a mind. Okay. Now, Arjuna says, well, I won't do my duty. You know, well, to understand the real background, psychological background of Gita, let us imagine, suppose there is school, an orphanage, or any institution, and that institution is facing a great threat. Let us say some violent elements. And the state has put some policemen in guard. I mean, to guard the school, to guard the children, guard the teachers, innocent little children. Suppose the policemen say, oh, we should not do any harm to these terrorists or those who may try to attack, to create violence against the school. It would be a great act of violence, so we should run away from it. Now, how ridiculous it would look. Suppose the school or an institution is facing a crisis. So 911 you call, and the police come, oh, we should not do any harm. The violence is going on, but we should not do any harm to these attackers or thieves. So let us go back. How ridiculous it will be. So that's what Arjuna was trying to do. Arjuna was really calling to the call 911. It's a battlefield. Innocent women, children, all these good people, non-violent people, spiritual seekers, sages, they were facing a great threat. So Arjuna was calling to help them and to save them from problems, from violence. And Arjuna says, no, I won't do anything. I will go back. So Krishna didn't tell, oh, you go back. You'll be practicing non-violence. Krishna didn't say that. You know what Krishna told? Any officer would say, you know, you should do your duty. You should help the people from violent elements, attackers. That's what Krishna did. So the first stage of action is action with perfect identification, with a strong sense of duty, responsibility, and not necessarily without expecting desire. You may expect desire, all right, but do a good, noble deed, your duty. That's the first step in the evolution of karma. It is called Sakama Karma. In fact, the first lesson, the primary kindergarten lesson that Krishna gives to Arjuna is the lesson of doing your duty instead of running away from your duties, obligations, and responsibilities. You must do your duty. You find in the gospel, in a totally different context, but much more touching and powerful. In the gospel, you know, there is a character, Azra. Azra was a God-fearing person, a good man, had faith in God, but he was sitting in front of Sri Ramakrishna's room, and also he was trying to make a little money out of it. I mean, and they will call the devotees to come here, you help me, you come. He used to drag them away from Sri Ramakrishna. But Sri Ramakrishna was full of mercy and kindness. He did not drive him away because he gave him also a place in his realm. But then you know what happened? The Hasra was a married man. And he had his parents who were poor. He had his children and his wife. They didn't have enough money. They didn't have a good home. They didn't have enough food to eat. And this man had deserted home, deserted them all. And had come to the temple and sitting there doing japa. Apparently, maybe there was a little bit of pretension also, trying to realize God, doing spiritual practice. Sri Ramakrishna says, you are totally wrong. You are a married person, you have children in your home, your parents look after, who are poor, who need your help. And you should go back to your home, you should try to feed your children, give them education, look after your parents. That's your first duty, a married man's duty. So he just left his home and coming to the temple and sitting there, apparently pretending to be doing spiritual practices. Sri Ramakrishna said, no, you should go back to your home. Do your thing. So Sri Ramakrishna had to use some strong language also to correct this fellow, to bring him to a sense of duty. Like that, the first lesson that Krishna gives to Arjuna is not karma yoga, but a karma action. If you cannot act without expecting desire, you act expecting desire with all efficiency, professionalism, enthusiasm. First. So in this, in the, you know, that's why in the second chapter, Krishna opens his conversation with using some strong language. It could be interpreted as invectives. Kutastva kasmalamidam vishame samupastitam anarejustam asvabhyam abhivirtikaram arjuna klaibhyam masma gamapatha nayatva yuvabaddhili kshudram kredaubhyam tektva uttishthavarandava. And kriba is not a complimentary word. If you look at the dictionary modern Indians, you won't like to be called a kriba. But that is the term Krishna uses to correct Arjuna, to bring him into a sense of duty. So many people, you don't understand the Sanskrit language, will take the Gita text and with great prayerful attitude chant this verse thinking that it's a sacred mantra. But actually Krishna is using invectives. So you should not desert your field of duties and responsibilities. Whatever may be your duty, whether you are a teacher, you are a factory worker, you are a soldier, you are an officer, whatever may be, a farmer, whatever may be, do your duty with perfect identification, enthusiasm, and effectively. You need not think of doing it without expecting desire. So many people frequently ask this question. I want to do my duty without expecting desire, but I'm not able to do that. You know what it means? You must take the first step. A kindergarten boy asks you, well, I'm not able to read the books prescribed for the Stanford University students. A kindergarten child may complain. What you should do? You go to kindergarten, study your lessons very well, and eventually after 20 years, you reach Stanford. Like that, Krishna tells Arjuna, don't try to think of practicing karma yoga. Practice karma means action, duty, your responsibility. But then, even if you become very proficient, very professional, very successful in doing your duty, that may not be enough. Because frequently, as I mentioned yesterday, I dealt with the subject during the first few sessions. Even if we do our work most efficiently, still we find by doing work, we become anxious about the results. And when the results are not exactly of the expectation, we become disappointed. And even after some time, after being successful in our duties, when the results are beyond even expectations, still after some time, when the situation changes again, we become anxious, depressed, or disappointed. So there's a problem with action, if done with desire. So Krishna says, do your duty, the best of your ability, but try to practice action without an obsessive desire for the result. Obsessed with desire or expectations. That's why in the Gita, almost a commentary on the Ichavasya Upanishad concept of karma yoga, Krishna makes a statement, sattaha karmani avidvamso yatha kurvanti bharata kurya vidvan tatha asattaha chirishu lokasandra. This is a great statement. What's the difference between a person who is doing their duty with all efficiency, very successful, very professional, and the work becomes quite effective. And another person who is doing his duty with the same level of efficiency and professionalism, but unattached. The former may be doing his duty or her duty with great expectation, with great desire, and very successful. The latter one has the same application and efficiency, and the work is equally effective, but without expecting desire. So the difference between a person of efficiency and desire and the person and the karma yogi is, a karma yogi has got the same level of efficiency, the same level of professionalism, but the same level of effectiveness, but no attachment, no desire. That's the only difference. If we could combine efficiency and enthusiasm, professionalism, and non-attachment, that means freedom from desire, then we can continue doing our duty with all success, with all effectiveness, and also we can avoid the problems of anxiety, concerns, complaints, and so on. Now, this is at the subjective level. Now, Gita, commenting on the verse, Tena Tyaktena Munchita, in the first verse of the Isavasya Upanishad, you should link your action, your enjoyment of the results of your action, to your transcendental spiritual ideal. How do we do this? Through the practice of renunciation, Tena Tyaktena. Enjoy through renunciation. So when you do that, the action produces an inner fulfillment, an inner joy, takes us closer to God, helps us in our spiritual evolution at the subjective level. At the objective level, you know, it helps you to live in perfect harmony with the whole creation. That is the other aspect of karma yoga. So the word yajna has got two important aspects. One, yajna, any action done as yajna means karma yoga, our duty, responsibility, then the perfect concentration, efficiency, but same time as an offering to God. Such an action, on the one hand at the subjective level, helps us to progress in spiritual life. At the objective level, helps us to live in perfect harmony and peace and integrity with our fellow human beings, not only fellow human beings, but with the whole creation. That is a unique interpretation that you find in the Gita. So, Gita therefore says, Yajnyatha karmanaha anyatra lokoyam karma bandhanaha dartham karma gaudeya mukta sankasamachara. The meaning is this. Actions done with desire, motive, with extreme obsessive desire, will have a binding effect in our life because it binds us. This expectation, if not fulfilled, creates disappointment, and even at the time of doing our duty, it makes us anxious, concerned about the results of our actions. Now, but so it binds you. It is a binding effect. It makes us a slave. Gita says we must try to work as freemen, as free women, and not as slaves. Now, there is one psychological element. If we do not make an attempt to do our duty and to live and work as freemen or freewomen, then we will have to work as slaves. There is no intermediary state. That's an important aspect in life. Whether you succeed in achieving full spiritual freedom through the practice of non-attachment or not, an attempt to do that helps you. That's an interesting aspect. Even an effort will have a liberating effect in our mental system. So Krishna says, yajnyatha karmana means do your duty as a yajna. Yajna, I will tell you, is a very interesting word and has got a lot of historical, philosophical significance. The word yajna. If you read Moni Williams or Apke or any of the modern dictionaries, you find yajna may be sometimes defined as a Vedic sacrifice. Sapta Havir Yajna. I mean, there are seven types of Vedic sacrifices which involve putting offering in fire. It's an ancient Aryan religious practice. when I use the word Aryan, it's called Arya in Sanskrit. Please, I think this needs some clear explanation, especially when we face, when we are talking to Western audience. So I will try to explain the word Arya. Remember, the word Arya or Aryan is in English language as pronunciation. Literally means in Sanskrit a cultured, a refined, a spiritually elevated person. This is the real meaning of the word Arya. So a dictionary is written in metrical form in 9th century AD. It is called Amarakosha. Kosha means a thesaurus dictionary put together. Not like Oxford or Chambers or Webster, but it is in metrical form. A huge book with a lot of commentaries. It is called Amarakosha. It is written by a great scholar called Amarasimha, one of the later lexicographers of India, because the first lexicon work belongs to 9th century BC. It is called Yastras Nidukta, the dictionary of the service on Vedic terminology. So this book is called Amarakosha. It defines the word Arya like this. Mahakula Kulinari Sadhya Sajjana Sathavala. Now we have to memorize all these when we are small. That's why it comes like this. It's a metrical form. So, Mahakula Kulinari Sadhya Sajjana Sathavala. Who is an Arya? Arya is a highly cultured person. Very noble, very broad-minded, a spiritually elevated person. So it's called Sajjana Sadhya, means highly unified. The one who can never do any harm to anybody, who loves the whole creation, a highly elevated soul, is called Arya. Mahabhagavaya, I mean, he endures these, perhaps, they all belong to some exalted traditions, conventional tribes or families, ancient Vedic, Aryan, you know, the Rishi tradition, the tradition of the sages, living maybe in the 7th or 8th millennium BC. Such people are called Aryans. You know, why this explanation is very much in demand, necessary, I tell you. Because when Max Muller tried to read the Vedas, he tried to interpret the word Aryan in his socio-anthropological and linguistic sense. This created a havoc, at least from to the Sanskrit noble term Arya. And later Bismarck also used it for unification of the Germanic people as a prelude to the Franco-Prussian War in maybe 1870 or something like that. And later in the 20th century, the term was used in a much more tragic sense and context, which I don't want to go into. So the whole story is this. The word Arya means noble, spiritually elevated, broad-minded, cultured people, like the ancient sages. So in a broader sense, you can say Jesus was an Aryan. He belonged to a Hebraic, Sumerian tribe, in a purely anthropological, ethnic sense. He was not didn't belong to Aryan race. But Jesus was an Aryan, according to the sense in which the word Aryan is used in Vedantic Vedic tradition. Buddha was an Aryan. Lao Tzu was an Aryan, belonged to Mangaloid. So any spiritually elevated person, anywhere in the world, in any tradition, is an Aryan. Now, in the Aryan, in the ancient Aryan Vedic tradition, yajna was an important ritual. Now, they used to erect huge tents called yajnashala. Huge tents. On the front of that tent, they had one writing. One writing was Agnaye Idam Nama. Idam Nama. Agnaye Idam Nama. Four words. Na is actually a word's negation. So all that we do is offered or being offered to God Agni, the God of fire. It's not mine. So this is the motto that used to be written on the front of every such temple. Even today, in certain parts of India, like Kerala, all these elaborate deity sacrifices are still going on. You can go to YouTube if you want, you can see the usual things. In fact, one of the great modern Vedic scholars who interpreted and who brought this to the attention of modern Western world was Fritz Stahl, who worked and was sponsored by the University of San Francisco, Berkeley, and who went almost for 14, 15 times to study these various sacrifices and who wrote books on this subject. Fritz Stahl was a very rich man who came to this country and was a professor of Indology and Sanskrit and comparative linguistics in philology in Berkeley. Okay, the subject is this. What does it mean in our context? Agne idam namama. Now, after performing all these offerings, rituals, they used to put this tent fire because it should be offered to the god of fire. Now, this was the motto. I mean, what I do is not mine. It is being offered to God. Fire god, god of fire, Agni, is the first, is the name of the first god mentioned in the Veda Samhita, in the Vedic literature. So, Agni Mele Purohitam Yajnisha Deva Muktisam Kotaram Ratnadhatam. So, we pray, we meditate upon God Agni. Because Agni, you know, Agni takes your offerings to different gods and goddesses. You offer, you put your offerings in fire. And the fire takes your offerings to different deities. So, Agni used to be considered to be Yajna Vahami, the vehicle, the instrument, the means by which your offering reaches your God. This idea. This is a mythological, I mean, symbolic description. Now, Gita says every act in our life should be done as a yajna. If you can do all our duties and responsibilities, not only work, physical activities, thoughts, ideas, contemplation, everything, as an offering, then, you know, it becomes a sacred, a spiritual performance. So every action gets spiritualized. Even the secular gets spiritualized. Rather, the difference between the secular and spiritual vanishes. Whole life gets a spiritual color. If you live and act like that, then you know what happens? It will, on the one hand, help you to live a very happy life in this world. Happy in the sense, happiness and peace and joy within, and perfect integrity and harmony with the whole creation. That's why it is said, you know, Sahayajna prajasushtva puravvaja prajapati anena prasavishyatthum eshos tishtakamadhu devan bhavayadanena te deva bhavayantuva Parasparam bhavayanta saya paramavapsana. Now, I shall try to explain this. So, it is in a symbolic way, the Gita says, the creator, when creator create this world, different human beings, he asked them, you should coexist in this world, you should live in perfect harmony with other beings. Other not only living beings, we should be able to live in perfect harmony with nature, with the mountains and valleys, trees, plants, sky, clouds, everything. We must be able to live in perfect harmony with the whole creation. Now, we will be able to live in perfect harmony with the whole creation, including human beings, only if we follow the path of Yajna. What is Yajna? Yajna, in the language of human interaction, is nothing but a philosophy of give and take. That's what Yajna really stands for. Give and take. Means, before you take, you should be willing to give. How do we do this? We have to do our work. We need the resources of the work. I mean, I'm talking about the ordinary empirical way of life. All right. Do your best, expert everything, but mentally remember, as Isavasya Upanishad says, The whole creation is pervaded by the divine reality. Each of us in themselves. This consciousness, this awareness will help us to give also, not only to think. If we can make this the motto of our life, then we won't do any injury, won't do any harm to any being in this world. We also will not cut down trees. We won't destroy earth. We won't destroy the ecological balance. We reach a level of perfect and intimate harmony, dignity, a harmonious relationship with the whole creation. So this interrelatedness, this integrity, harmonious relationship is the external aspect of yajna. So yajna, which is karma yoga, yajna is nothing but karma yoga. Karma yoga interpreted from another perspective is called yajna. So do our best. When we do our best and also mentally give up desire, then what happens? Then becomes yajna. If we do everything with great obsessive desire, expectation and selfish motive, then it is only take. Mentally, if we also keep in mind, we should also give. Giving means what? Giving doesn't literally mean giving something to somebody. By trying to link our action to the ideal of renunciation, by linking ourselves to this higher transcendental ideal, the truth that the whole world creation is pervaded by the divine reality, then it becomes give. So give and take policy, in its most universal sense, is called yajna. So that's why it is said, it's a symbolic statement. The Creator told living beings, you should live in perfect harmony with whole nature. Deva, see, Devan bhavayatanena, te deva bhavayanta. So, by this yajna, you should entertain the gods and let the gods entertain you. Entertaining each other, you will both attain supreme good. So, Ishtan Bhogan Hivo Deva Dasindi Yikne Bhavida Taidatana Pradaya Vyo Yogum Tristena Evasa Yikne Sistasina Sundu Muchinde Sarvati Bishaihi Gunjade Te Togam Papa Ye Pajan Yatma Karana. I shall read a few verses, I shall try to interpret, I shall recite these verses because this gives a very wonderful philosophy of human life. The last statement should be made at the very beginning. You know what last statement means? Those who do not follow this path of yajna, what yajna it is, we are going to explain. Yajna is called yajna chakra, this cycle, this interrelatedness, this philosophy of life based on mutual cosmic harmony, mutual understanding with the whole creation. So it is this cycle that is described here. I should explain the cycle. So those who do not follow this integrated philosophy of harmonious existence, what happens, you know? They are breaking the very rhythm, the very harmony of existence. Take a simple example. If you destroy all the forests, if you construct dams everywhere, blocking the flow of the river, or emission of gas elements, you know, leading to global warming and things like, well, many things, there are many things coming one after another, the chain reactions. What happens, you know? We are breaking this harmonious chain, this harmonious rhythm of cosmic existence. And such a person is leading a sinful life. And what happens, you know, he is actually eating the sinful fruits of his own activities. Now, what is this cycle that is described here? The cycle gives us a picture of what Lord Krishna is talking about. It means, see, Anna Bhavanti Bhutani. All living beings are dependent upon food. Means, they are born from food, means everybody, everything, including the bacteria, including all human beings, everyone needs some sustenance. So, Anna Bhavanti Bhutani, all living, Bhutani means anything that is born, living beings, are born from food, means dependent upon food, some sustenance. And where do we get food? The context is from the ordinary human life. We won't get food grains unless there is rain. So, Parjanya Dhanna Sambhav means food depends upon the plenty of rains, necessary for food grains to grow. Ayajnyan Bhavati Parjanya. What happens, you know? And where does rain come from? Rain comes from Yajna. Here I need some explanation. And therefore, yajna sacrifice results from action. Now, yajna here means if you violate nature, if you do anything that is against this cycle of yajna, this integratedness or interrelatedness of human existence, it could upset the whole balance of cosmos. Rains may not, there may not be enough rains that will result in scarcity of food grains. People will suffer. I mean, the whole human life will be affected if people break this chain of harmony and interrelatedness. So, if people follow this path of yajna, this the cycle of interrelatedness, then karma brahmo bhavam vichi. Karma means this act of yajna, this concept of action without desire, which is necessary for keeping even ecological balance intact. Because after all, what is the reason for destruction of forests? Human greed. What's the cause of global warming? Human greed. What's the cause of many of the problems which are apparently beyond human control? Human greed. What is greed? Greed is nothing but an attempt to break this cycle of interrelatedness or harmonious life or harmonious existence. So greed is the root cause of most of the problems we are facing in this world. And greed is responsible for breaking these harmonious life forms. So the whole cycle called Yajna Chakra, one depending on the other, one related to the other. So this interrelatedness is affected or will be destroyed when we become greedy. And how to get rid of greed? Greed can be got rid of only through the practice of action without desire, karma yoga, or yajna. You cannot get away from karma because it is invariable. We cannot get away from the need to produce more food grains. We cannot get away from the need to use more technology for spreading education. All these may be inevitable things that we have to go through in the natural human evolution, in the growth of human civilization. We cannot go back to the Lockhart age. But the point is, we can do one thing, we can afford to do that, we can get rid of this greed element from the modern civilization. And that is possible through this practice of the Yajna principle. And what's the root, what is the central theme of Yajna? Unselfishness, freedom from greed, freedom from too much of desire, or attachment, or obsessive attachment to physical, empirical enjoyment. That is the root cause of greed. So that is why it is said, Yajna helps us to enjoy inner peace by living in this world, doing our duties and responsibilities on the one hand. Yajna means the Niskarma Yoga helps us to live in perfect peace and harmony and integrity with the whole creation. One depends on the other. If the earth is affected, we cannot have peace of mind. Maybe the next, the coming generations will be, of course, at the receiving end. That's all. We'll be only postponing the problem. So Krishna says, any action done as yajna will liberate us from greed, from bondage. And any action done as yajna will help us to live in perfect peace and harmony within, in our inner life, and also without, in our external life. Now, after finishing this subject, we will take up another very interesting and very, not unrelated, but equally relevant subject. Frequently, you know, in modern times, we don't study history. We don't study anything related to the ancient human heritage. So this all, see, if somebody tells you, well, this idea was stated in the works of Aristotle or Eckhart or the Vedas, well, what do they, how are they relevant to our times? So we try to live in islands, isolated places. That is, in fact, that's one problem why many people, many students studying modern universities, mostly focusing on technology-related topics, are not able to understand many of these higher principles. So in Sanskrit, it's called parampara. It's mentioned in the fourth chapter of Gita, where Lord Krishna is about to begin a great exposition on the idea of Karma Yoga and other related topics. It's like this. Imam vivasade yogam proktava naham avyam vivasvan manave praga man ikshaga yadravi evam parampara praptam imam rajasya vidhusakari neha mahada yogo nashta parantava. What he is trying to expound is the great philosophy of Karma Yoga. That's the focus of our discussion during this retreat. And he makes one point. This Karma Yoga is not a new idea. He is referring to an ancient age where great men, not necessarily sages and saints living in hermitages, but great kings and emperors were very busy, who had to be very efficient, practiced this freedom from greed, freedom from attachment, freedom from bondage in the midst of their day-to-day activities. That's what he's referring to. So he gives, it's called parampara, means spiritual succession. And then he says, evam parampara praptam, evam rajasyantra. So this idea of karma yoga, how did we get it? Parampara praptam means through a succession of great teachers and their teachers and their disciples, who later became teachers. Like that, through a succession of teachers, we inherited this great spiritual heritage. And while referring to the great exponents and also practitioners of this great Karma Yoga ideal, he uses one word, is Rajasya, literally means philosopher kings. Not like Plato's concept of philosopher king in the Republic. Because only philosopher can be an ideal king. But here means Raja and Rishi, the two words are used. Raja means king or emperor. Rishi means a sage. Totally different if you look at them from the external profession and demands for their duties and responsibilities. The king has to be very busy, very efficient, very extrovert from an ordinary perspective. And a sage has to be an introvert. A sage should be totally illiterate in terms of worldly knowledge. That's our understanding, not correct understanding, it's a misunderstanding, really speaking. And a king should be worldly minded, ambitious, restless, efficient, full of desire. That's what we normally expect. But here, a totally different personality and different philosophy of life is being expounded. Literally means Rajanista Rishayasta Rajasya. This literally means those who are kings and also emperors rolled into one. How can you be a king and also a philosopher, a sage, at the same time? So there is a great psychological insight that one of the commentators displayed by trying to expound. His name is Shankarananda Saraswati, who wrote a Tiga, a super commentary on Shankaracharya's commentary. So he says, you know who is a king? A Rajitum hi Aishwarya Sambhati. A king should be very rich, very active, very efficient, very professional. Prosperity, wealth, all these are hallmarks of a king or an emperor. He's a worldly minded man. And a sage is one who understands the limitation of this material prosperity. So, Rishittvam ki tasyaha sokshmartha darsana kshamattu. That's the Diga definition given by Shankaranda Saraswati. Sage is one who realizes the limitation of material prosperity. That's the hallmark of a philosopher. And a philosopher looks beyond today. He looks beyond this minute. He looks beyond the empirical. He looks beyond what is visible right now. It's called farsight or insight from two different perspectives. That's what makes a philosopher. I don't mean academic philosophy. When we talk about philosophy, we have to think of Aristotle. We think of Socrates. We have to think of great. When I talk about philosophy, please don't mind, I'm a bit prejudiced in this matter. The great philosophical heritage of Greece is what I have in mind when I talk about philosophy in connection with saintliness. Because they were in search of great universal spiritual truths. I am not talking about modern philosophers. I mean they're students of philosophy, thinkers, you can say. So philosophers should be always perpetually, always in quest of truth. That's the hallmark of philosophy. So a philosopher looks beyond the empirical, beyond the visible, beyond today, beyond this minute. It's a trans-empirical perspective in life. So he understands the limitation of prosperity. He understands limitations, all those things which are necessary for a king. Suppose you combine together in your personality the efficiency of, let us say, modern time, the great age, so to speak, and also the wisdom of a great ancient saints, the contemplative nature. I mean, the efficiency, professionalism, plus an understanding and awareness of the limitation of efficiency and professionalism. That is the meaning. Tasyaha sukshmartha darsana kshamartha. Literally means the wisdom that enables you to understand the limitation or the true meaning of prosperity. What is that? the physical prosperity, the material prosperity is there today, but tomorrow it won't be there. It comes, but it goes away. It is not eternal. It is perishable. It is transitory. This awareness is the hallmark of a philosopher. Now the point is, suppose you combine these two, well, this is what makes you karma yogi, in the true sense of the term.
Mm.
Now you have to remember, frequently, oh, I cannot become an Aristotle, I cannot become a Janaga, I cannot become... It's true. But Gita makes an interesting point. Even if we sincerely make an effort to practice this, it liberates you from bondage. So you need not reach the destination. You just try to start your journey. Krishna makes an interesting promise. Svalpam apyasya dharmasya prayati mahato bhaya. It really means what? Little practice. A little practice means what? Even if you try to intellectually understand and make an effort to practice, that itself means your spiritual evolution has started. You have started on a spiritual journey. That's the uniqueness of this principle. So it is very important to listen to the voice of the great masters of the past. This constitutes parampara. The bane of modern education is, we all think the world started today in 2016. And the human civilization is only a few minutes or a few hours old. Because that's the perspective, the way we look at things. That's why the ancient lawgiver Manu says, Vidyadvisevira sadvi nityam advesharagidhi hrudayena abhyanityadu ko dharma tat. That means here. So Manu is an ancient lawgiver. He says, who are these ancient teachers? So they are completely free from raga, dvesha means hatred, aversion, prejudices, and so on. So they have understood, realized this within their hearts. They are free from greed and hatred, and they have realized this in their hearts. It's called this dharma. Dharma based on yajna. Non-violence, and also freedom from greed and karma yoga idea. Now, without this parampara, without belief, a strong belief that we are in distinguished company of the ancient sages, we will not be able to practice karma yoga. That's a main practical problem in modern times. As I said earlier, if we cannot look back and draw inspiration from the past tradition, from the ancient tradition, from the universal spiritual cultural heritage of humanity, we won't get a direction as to how to practice karma yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Modern business management cannot help us. Even business management, if you may do meditation, but that also is a means to make a few more extra dollars to increase profit rate by 1 or 2%, so that you'll be more peaceful, more calm, and so you'll do more work and make more profit. So there again, our action is linked, is tied to a few more extra dollars. It's a purely utilitarian way of life and philosophy of life. So unless we learn to do things without a thought as to how this is going to help us to make a few more extra dollars, you won't be able to start off practice karma yoga. So it is important also to learn to sit quiet and think without a thought as to how my action is going to help me to succeed in the sense such as means making a few more extra dollars. And for that we have to draw inspiration from the past. Because the present cannot give us inspiration. Of course, there are many great men, great women in modern times also, but they all draw their inspiration from some tradition, some ancient tradition. That's an important idea to remember. We are continuing the discussion on Karma Yoga. I think we have got about 5 minutes more. So when we practice the yajna, what happens? going back to Isavasya Upanishad, says, Na karma lippede nara, you find the second verse, Kurvanneva iha karmami, didi visheshatam samaha, evan turinanyadhidosti, Na karma lippede nara. So you can live for 100 years, that's what it means, doing your action. Performing your action as karma yoga, or yajna. Linking our life to this renunciation idea. You know, by trying to make ourselves prosperous, being aware of the fact that prosperity itself has its limitation, focusing our mind on some higher idea. Now, such a life helps us to be free from bondage. How does it happen? So an example is given, you know, a lotus leaf which grows in water. Padma patra mivamthasa means. Padma means lotus leaf. A lotus leaf growing in water doesn't become wet. It's not affected by the water. Like that, we'll be able to live in this world, but we need not necessarily be worldly minded. If our life is a boat, and the river is the what is the world, we can take this boat across the river without the water entering the boat. In fact, the boat should be on water. Water should not be inside the boat. It can, there is no other intermediary stage. If water is inside the boat, you won't survive the boat journey. You won't reach the other bank of the river. So the life, that's the boat, should be on water surface. It can remain unaffected by the currents, the waves, in the river. So Shankaracharya writes in a masterly commentary, says, Yavad jivam karma kurvati api vidushi purushe na karma lepaya bhavati. Give the reason, vidya samarthya, Shankaracharya says. How is it possible? Yavat jivam karma gurvade, you work for 24 hours of your life. Be active. Like a king, you know, that we mentioned, mm-hmm. the philosopher king, a king cannot afford to be lazy or inefficient or negligent. Whole nation will suffer. He has to be active. At the same time, if he is only active, he is a worldly minded person, he cannot become a philosopher king. He will be only king. He cannot become a Rajashi, he'll only be a king. So how to combine kingliness and saintliness? How to put them together in our personality? So Shankaracharya throws light on this subject. So he says, Yavat jivam karma kurvati api. Even if we work a whole lifetime, 24 hours of the day, 7 days of the week, Vidushi Purusheena Karma Lepaya Bhavati. If you are a knowledgeable person, if you are practicing it as a karma yoga, if you are trying to live like a philosopher king, combining kingliness, kingly efficiency and dynamism, and saintly contemplation and introspective nature, then he says, Nalepaya Bhavadi, it won't affect you. Your boat will be able to take you across the river. Water will not be inside the boat. The boat will be on water surface. He gives the reason, Vidya Samarthya. What is Vidya Samarthya? Because we understand the dynamics of Karma Yoga. That's Vidya. So if we have an awareness of the true nature of action, then without desire, which helps us to do all our duties but still remain unaffected by the problems of life. Just like a boat takes you across the river without the water entering the boat. If the water enters the boat, it will capsize. Death. On the other hand, if the boat is properly directed, if the water remains in the river, not inside the boat, can take you across the river. That's what he means by Vidya Samarthya. This proper awareness, this knowledge of Karma Yoga will help us to take our life across So live peacefully with all the needs of material life fulfilled with efficiency and dynamism. At the same time, fully understand the limitation of all that we are enjoying if you, by linking ourselves to Tyaga, renunciation idea. The first verse of these hours. That's why you have to remember many of these ideas are meant to be practiced by people living their everyday life in this world. Whether housewives, officers, kings, people who have lived in this world. It is not meant to be contemplated upon by sages only in the hermitages. It is a philosophy that enables us to combine spirituality and the realities of everyday life into one integrated way of life. So, the realities, the demands and challenges of everyday life, material life. And also, the limitation of the tools with which we try to solve the problems of life. So, these two ideas, that means contemplation of a saint, the contemplativeness of a saint, the contemplative nature of a saint, and the dynamism of the king, rolled into one. That is the essence of Karma Yoga.
So now we will have interaction for half an hour. Tomorrow is the last session, so we can perhaps ask questions related to the previous sessions as well.
Swami, are you saying that those first lines of the work that we're studying, that those are the answer to how to combine kingliness and saintliness?
Yeah. See, first line, if you got attached with you, first, Isha Mahasimi themselves. The whole world, creation, is pervaded by the divine reality. It is a saint who realizes this in his contemplation. That he teaches you. Okay. Now, how to live in this world? So there's a tena tek tena gunchitha. Gunchitha, the word means enjoy this world. That's literally. It means eating food and enjoy the world. How? By linking our mind to the renunciation idea. Why renunciation? If the world is pervaded by the divine reality, the world is not our property for us to make use of, to exploit and enjoy. So we must live in this world. We may be able to do our duty, everything, but remember it belongs to God. Or rather is divine. It is not our property. That compels us to practice the ideal of renunciation. Mm-hmm. That is the saintliness of a saint.
Yes.
That's how you get it. Right.
Swami, how would you determine, not determine, but define the difference between non-attachment and renunciation?
Yeah. In fact, they are both same. We'll be able to practice non-attachment only if you have a sense of renunciation. So renunciation doesn't mean giving up physically. See, without an idea of renunciation, we won't be able to remain unattached. It is rooted in the idea of renunciation. You see, remember, the word attachment should be understood here. I need some explanation of different kinds of context. Here, attachment literally means obsessive attachment to something, almost creating a kind of spiritual slavery. That's the real meaning of attachment. It is not the attachment of a mother to a child, or that the attachment of a child to the mother, nothing of the kind. What attachment here means is obsessive attachment to something to such an extent that it makes you your slave. It creates a bond. You see, mother loving the child is actually enjoying freedom. Child loving the mother is also enjoying blissfulness and freedom. So it should not be understood in that context. But suppose we get attached to something, we want to get rid of it. We know it's not the right thing for us. We would be happy to get rid of it. But we cannot bring our mind to do that. So it creates a kind of dilemma, a kind of spiritual slavery, spiritual bondage. How do we get out of it? Through non-attachment. So that's the real meaning of the word Sangha as understood in Sanskrit. So very often, you know, in translations, they won't be able to give a full extended interpretation of the word. So frequently, you know, non-attachment is maybe the only word used. So we understood in that context. Attachment, being attached to something in spiritual life means you are bound to certain things, you know it is something not pleasant, still you are not able to come out of it. As Swamiji explained in his definitions of Maya. That's idea. It is not to be understood in the context of intimate human relationships. It's not understood. So it is clear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I thought your second subject that you introduced today is so essential and so profound.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking of just a few responses that, you know, we seem to be confronted with so many insoluble problems today. And I was thinking that we don't see the solutions because we're so immersed in the empirical and we're cut off from this great tradition of the philosophers,
yeah.
Socrates and Plato, and who do more than enrich our lives. They help us see solutions and how to get out of the problems that we've created for ourselves. And also I was thinking that, well, you know, there's an American poet who said in the 1930s that he felt there was a cultural blackout going on in the 20th century, that whole, you know, the great spiritual traditions were being sort of wiped out and silenced. And then I was thinking that just a small group of us who appreciate these immortal ideas and love them and read them, and the more we do that, the more we will help the world. You know, even if they're just a handful of us,
yeah,
who pick up a dialogue by Plato or, you know, or you can read Emerson or Thoreau, that's going to help,
yeah,
the whole world. And it seems like a small contribution, but I think it's, you know, we have to keep the light of this spiritual knowledge alive.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought what you said was
wonderful. Yeah. The so-called philosophers of modern times, they want to pick up every little thing and interpret as something by itself, in total isolation to everything else.
Yeah.
So, in a way, I would say one great, I don't know whether it could be called great or not, one Indian thinker, radical thinker, made a great contribution in this respect. Asking questions on everything, questioning everything. If you say anything, well, that's also anything. Now, it borders on kind of a destructive skepticism or anarchism or something, questioning everything. As if he's expounding great truth. So, I won't say frequently we don't do that, you know, because in our tradition we don't do. If we talk about guru, who is a guru? The guru is a, why should he be? What is yoga? What do you mean by yoga? Why should he? So, practically, if you chase every single word, then either you can learn and end up in lunatic asylum, or you can become a stark anarchist. Iconoclasm in its worst form, you find. And they were often taken to be thinkers in modern philosophy. On the other hand, great man like Swami Vivekananda, who came here, presented before a real solid philosophy, he prescribed a means. That's why Swamiji quotes from Kant and,
yes,
others. You know. Today, perhaps, in a Vedantic context, we can't refer to
those thinkers, because the academic trend has changed a lot in modern times.
But there are, Barbara and I know some students at UC, at Berkeley, wonderful students, very spiritually minded, and they're very specialized.
Yeah.
They're in very demanding fields, and they don't, well, they aren't given opportunities to take philosophy and to read. And so they hardly know anything about the past, as you were speaking of. And I don't know what my response to that is, other than it seems like there is a tremendous need for
I know some thinkers in India who take everything from the Gita and other Shankaracharya's commentaries. At the same time, they talk as if it's theirs.
Yes.
If you say, what about Vedas? I don't need any Vedas. I have no time to read it. But then whatever little things they're worthwhile in their teachings are coming from this.
That's right.
That trend is, I mean, to de-link with the ancient past.
Yes.
Now, the one main problem is, if in course of time, they'll be forgotten.
They will.
And, of course, naturally they'll be forgotten. Because if a branch of a tree makes a declaration of independence from its roots.
From the tree.
And it cannot exist anymore, you know. Or a leaf or a fruit or a branch of a tree says, I am myself, I came from earth independent of roots, you know. This often happens.
Yeah.
It may fall down and it may wither away, it may vanish once more. This is what is happening now. So there is no succession.
Didn't Ramakrishna say, as long as I live, I learn?
Yeah.
He said that. That was such a wonderful...
Swami, I heard a comment recently, there is no philosophy in Western philosophy. And that was my experience when I was at the undergraduate level, that almost everybody that was studying philosophy was doing logical exercises as preparation to go to law school. And there seems to be this trend from the modern period of throwing away everything from the past. There's nothing that matters from the past. All that religious mythology is just a bunch of fairy tales. All of the wisdom of the ancients, they had no wisdom. They were just primitives and barbarians. We know everything. We're the best because we have mobile phones. Right, and it's all technical. There seems to be out of the Protestant Reformation, there's this great scientific revolution. The scientist, though, has to take things just as they appear on the surface, and so because this scientific mind takes everything just as it appears on the surface, that literal mind then looks at religious mythology or the analogical thinking of the philosophers and looks at it too just on the surface and then says, well, that's ridiculous, and throws it away. But you see, there's a deeper level that they're missing because there's a level of interpretation and meaning that's deeper than just on the surface of things.
The Swamiji, one of Swami Vivekananda's well-known statements was this, you know, I preach nothing but the Upanishads. Mm-hmm. Now, after speaking all these, all the lectures, everything, people thought this Swami Vivekananda brought a new philosophy. But he said, I have preached nothing but the Upanishads.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you find great thinkers in Western world also, but somehow they attempt to break off from the ancient pre-Christian philosophical tradition of the West. I mean the Greek. That will be philosophically suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a ruse.
Mm-hmm.
And see, Socrates was a wise man, Aristotle was a wise man, Plato was a wise man. Can we say Wittgenstein is a wise man? That's in the Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Can say that?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, but when you read it, you can see the figure of a man like Socrates sitting somewhere who had a higher, deeper far sight into the true nature of human being, the true meaning of life and creation, you can see. You don't associate that kind of foresight with modern thinkers who want to take everything in disconnected pieces and interpret in isolation from everything else, without integrating, without realizing it's a part of the natural evolution of Western thought.
There is Aristotle's influence in the scientific mind of the modern period, but Aristotle is basically an introduction to Plato, and all of Western philosophy is just a footnote to Plato. And so there's a tremendous loss when there's just on the arc of philosophy just being on one side of it. There's a huge loss of information, wisdom, meaning, purpose by becoming so narrow.
Yeah. Anything more to discuss?
So there's a statistic that says 1% of the population controls 99% of the wealth. So what do you think that means for the collective consciousness of the people?
The first part was not clear.
There's a statistic, modern, that says 1% of the world's population controls 99% of the wealth. And I know we talk about spiritual suicide and we talk about prosperity and the idea of action. What do you think that means for the people on the planet today?
Yeah, it has more to do with the political system, which influences the way wealth, human wealth, is being distributed or utilized. It has more to do with the political system and other related functions of modern government, finance, and economic theories and all that. So that's true, that's a major problem.
So
if the only way, if we can have more and more people discussing these higher ideas, and if such people happen to be very active in those areas, that's only hopeful. That's why people who have this higher philosophical insight, if they happen to become functionaries of ruling government, then we would achieve that.
That's not a small response, because in the same sense that we go to universities or ask the graduates what their personal philosophy has become, they're often at a loss. Mm-hmm. And if you ask people in positions of public service and high duty and responsibility to the public what their philosophy is, they're often at a loss. If you ask them to make reference to any fundamentals in the history of thought, they're at a loss. More often than not, they're at a loss. So these remarks that we're making and what we're endeavoring to do in our efforts here and in our individual journeys is probably, as Swami said, the very antidote to the distresses that we see around us.
You know, the question was, you know, how 1% controls this world, including wealth. So, as I said, it has more to do with the political system. So, but of course, there are a few who are more enlightened than the rest. But we can have more people who are like philosophers. That's the point. And Plato is farsight. So Krishna is a Rajarshi, the one who is a king and also a saint. Saint means saintly philosopher. So in that sense, one who could see beyond the empirical reality. You can be prosperous, but you're also aware of the limitation of being prosperous. These two aspects of together.
You also mentioned greed this morning, Swami. You know, greed.
Yeah, greed, yeah.
And I think that Kathy may relate
True.
A little bit to what you were saying, that that's that
Yeah.
Unbridled.
You could also say that only 1% are totally deluded. That 99% operate somewhat from the true heart, altruistic nature, where they help each other at a grassroots level. Because you see communities thriving at a local level, even with problems, and it brings up the heart of karma yoga within the individual. So, in a positive sense, maybe only 1% are completely deluded.
See, in narcissist encounters, the common appropriate response will be, well, we have certainly made some progress, but not enough. We are still going a long distance. That's all we can say. So, see, these ideas are being discussed by serious-minded people to a small group is a good thing, better than nothing, but that's not enough. It should. It can become part of the academic curriculum to be studied by students. But I tell you, an educational system which is exclusively technology obsessed, profit obsessed, obsessed with management, science, marketing, it is certainly heading for a problem.
Yes.
Any educational system which neglects history or philosophy or literature, certainly it has a problem. Because the human mind is composed of not only purposes and ideas and goals and targets, but also emotions and feelings. It should be trained and refined and processed. So an educational system which becomes obsessed with technology doesn't have a way to feed and refine and process.
That's right.
And train human emotions, human feelings, which really constitute, which really determine how we live and respond to different situations. Technology cannot teach us how to make use of technology.
That's good.
Only wisdom can. And this wisdom comes from maybe an awareness of the past history of human civilization. And Aristotle or Plato, if you read, you may be more sensible in making use of the tools of technology, because technology gives you power and knowledge. But how to make proper use of this power, the gifts of science and technology, power of knowledge, and to desist from using improper use of them. So there's no mean, there's no way to do that. It needs training of the human emotions, human feelings. We determine the way we react and we make use or we make misuse of science and technology. So that's the main problem.
When actually a very vocal and strong minority, you know, makes the decisions about, you know, how the, you know, wealth distribution or whatever, education has to be done, you know, you cannot blame only this minority vocal 1% or 2%, because the what the 99-98% are doing is allowing them to carry the day, even in a democracy.
Yeah.
Good.
So what is this, you know, the rest of the people, you know, are they, you know, above blame for their condition? You know, this is, there is a lot,
yeah,
you know, this is some thinking.
That's right.
That line,
you know, remember, Plato possibly did not imagine the way we understand democracy today. The Plato was thinking of philosopher kings. He was not talking about an ideal democratic state, nation state.
Yes, yes.
That's
right. So, we could not take into consideration many of the problems that modern democracies are facing. The majority decides everything. The majority may not have read Plato. They don't read it.
The majority is not a thinking, you know.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Majority,
I mean, yeah,
know,
they don't read it for
the
first
word.
Yeah.
That's problem.
That's, therefore, that's the negative side of democracy, with all its other greatness.
Plato had a great distrust of democracy.
Yeah, yes.
Democracy put Socrates to death.
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw some statistics.
Yes, so that's the thing.
Mm-hmm. And it said that, I saw some statistics, and that it said that 40% of people in college are studying business.
Yeah.
And it's something like 4% study literature, like 3% study history, and less than 1%, statistically zero, study philosophy. And you see, what we lose when we lose the humanities and the study of the humanities is we lose what this understanding of what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. And if all we're studying is business and technology, we're just becoming machines. We're not becoming fully human. We're becoming just tools in an economic machine and machine made.
You heard about this thing the scientists are contemplating about the artificial intelligence?
Right, well, they should try getting some intelligence first before they create a machine that has intelligence.
Yes.
For some of those surveys, you have to certify that you're not a robot or something. You need to take it.
Swami, is there a line of demarcation between prosperity and greed? Does one follow the other? I'm not clear.
I think it's mostly a matter of our perspective.
The greed.
And a Veer-Veer person who is making, who is investing a lot of his money for the good of others, he could be very prosperous, but may not be greed, or may have less of it. On the other hand, a person who may be rich but not that rich won't do anything for others. So he may be prosperous in the limited sense, but then may be greedy. So often it's a matter of the way we make use of what we have. That's what decides whether we greedy or greedy or not. Greed has something to do with the way we make use of what we have got. That's it. A poor man can be very greedy, mm-hmm. and a rich man can be very liberal. We won't care anything for it. So, there's an absolute principle. What we can say is whether one is greedy or not has more to do with the way he or she makes use of what he has got. So, thank you. We will have my last session tomorrow. So, Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Sri Ram.